across Australia is up to 1 billion.
Most people sort of fantasize about flying. Most people think about it. So rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? I've only done like 1%.
And bang, within like a split second, I had no time to react. I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.
Good evening and welcome to Razor's Edge. My name is Monica Samayoa, and for the next half an hour, we'll be looking at issues that concern you as well as arts and cultures from around our community. From the big stuff to the small stuff, it all affects you and it's all covered here at Razor's Edge. Tonight, we speak with Professor Kath Albury from the Swinburne University of Technology as she explains to us what image-based abuse is and how it relates to revenge porn. Then we have a new Seeking Sydney story. I went out to the Sydney Harbor and answered the question, how did they build Fort Denison on such a tiny island in the middle of Sydney Harbor? Lastly, we hear from the host of Glam City and their conversation about decolonizing the archives. So stick around, Sydney, because we got you covered here at Razor's Edge on 2SCR 107.3.
UTS Function Centre.
Impress your guests at the award-winning Function Centre located in the heart of UTS campus.
Your guests will love the sweeping terraces with views of the Anzac Bridge and ever-changing cityscape.
We can tailor an event to suit your needs.
Give us a call today to see how we can help you make your event something to remember.
02 95 14 1632.
Aerial UTS Function Centre sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Revenge porn has been making headlines for the past several months, but many people still don't really know what constitutes as revenge porn, or rather, image-based abuse. Ellie Madrid spoke with Professor of Media and Communication Kath Albury from the Swinburne University of Technology, who breaks down the word for us and explains who the abusers and the victims are.
So, Kath, what constitutes image-based abuse?
Okay, there's a fantastic report on image-based abuse that was published by Nicola Henry, Anastasia Power and Asher Flynn at RMIT, and they make it really clear that it's a range of things, and that's actually why the term image-based abuse is being used these days as opposed to revenge porn.
What was wrong with the term revenge porn?
Often the pictures are not circulated by someone who perceives some injustice has been done. So, you know, they weren't even in a relationship with the person. And often the images really aren't porn. It can be a range of things from kind of creep shots, upskirts or down tops, pictures on public transport, those kind of non-consensual pictures. Many people with disabilities report being a victim of image-based abuse. There's concern that people who, you know, for example, rely on other people to help them get changed and that kind of thing, are victimised by people that they trust to look after them, taking pictures without their consent. It's not just about, I mean, you know, there's a kind of stereotypical image of, oh, a silly young kid who was sexting and then they broke up and the picture was shared for revenge, quote unquote. There's really significant evidence to suggest that people who are kind of in their teens up to about 29 are at a higher risk. Mm-hmm. It happens to people at a range of ages, and both men and women can be victims.
So you're saying that a lot of the time these vulnerable members of society, like, for example, people with a disability, are largely affected by image-based abuse. Who are generally the abusers?
The abusers are more likely to be men. So in the study, and this is a study of people who were interested in doing the research, it wasn't a population-wide study, but the perpetrators were about 54% men, about 33% female, and then there were about 13% where the victim didn't know what gender the abuser was.
And what do you think motivates people to take these actions and post a humiliating or graphic image of somebody online?
Where perpetrators have been interviewed, which they have actually in a small study in the UK, often it's a kind of complete lack of empathy, in a sense, for the victim. So they're taking the picture to share with a friend because they think it's funny, and they don't necessarily take into account that this is an actual person who will be hurt by that. In some cases, obviously in some cases it's done to manipulate a person. So there's a term, sextortion, which basically refers to taking pictures or keeping pictures and not sharing them, but using them as a threat to someone else. Like, if you don't do X or Y, if you leave me, I will share the pictures.
Blackmail.
So a form of abusive blackmail. And then there are times, yes, when it's deliberately done for sexual enjoyment for that individual or for others. But there seem to be a range of reasons that people do it, and a fairly significant percentage are just not acknowledging the shame or humiliation or distress it will cause the victim. They're doing it entirely, for the lols, if you like.
For the lols. And if we take a step back and look at the external factors that may create a space for people to do these things or perform these actions, do you think that there has been a conflation of what people understand as private and what people understand as public in the age of the internet, in a world where almost everything is documented on social media, smartphones are constantly in our hands, the ability to basically broadcast worldwide is kind of always just a click away? Do you think that a conflation like this contributes to the issue of image-based abuse?
Look, it might to an extent, but most pictures that are discussed in this context, in the kind of criminal setting, are not shared on social media. They're shared more privately. It's easier to more seamlessly share pictures, and certainly, people report that pictures, can be shared very widely to a wide range of people. The idea that, because of the technology, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. There's obviously a pre-digital history of hidden cameras and that kind of thing. So a kind of non-consensual, voyeuristic practice of taking pictures of people, and also of kind of surveillance pictures and those kinds of things. And also there's a sense of entitlement in some ways, being able to access material or access actions of people if they are in public. There's not always a sense of, well, publicness has a context in the same way privacy has a context.
Sure.
And actually, that consent is still relevant in all those different cases.
In public, everything's fair game for the lols, as you said.
well, there's that kind of assumption, but in actual fact, there are, many spaces where people who argue that very strongly are the first ones to cry defamation or libel or, invasion of privacy if it happens to them. So it's often a very one-sided argument, that argument.
And what do you think of the common misconception that what happens on the internet isn't real, or that a digital action that takes place online doesn't really count, so to speak? Do you think that this is a misconception that might contribute to the image-based abuse epidemic?
I don't have a sense that people think what happens on the internet isn't real. I don't think people are always as conscious as they might be of the ways that images or conversations can be taken out of context in a digital space. And I'm not just talking about images. I'm talking about that whole, but the students who started sledging the author of the Mango poem last week and were very hurt when she dared to take it personally. what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, well, personal abuse actually is personal.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether you type it or say it to someone's face. It still has a personal impact. So, that partly is a kind of effect of anonymity in some cases. So, there has been some research on what's termed disinhibition, that if people feel like they can't be identified as the person who took a picture or shared a picture or made the abusive comment.
And I guess that idea
is they feel more free to make it.
Yeah, and I guess that idea kind of traces back to a pre-internet era as well, with the idea that people who wore masks, I think they did studies a long time ago, that if you were wearing a mask, you felt much more free to release your inhibitions than if you were showing your face.
Yeah, and anonymous, there's a history of anonymous hate mail and that kind of thing. So I'm always wary of the kind of blanket statement, oh my God, the internet's making us do these things. I think it works both ways. We make the internet do certain things because we want it to do those things. And digital tools also make certain kinds of things easier to do with less forethought and less effort.
And just to end, the West Australian government has identified concerns with legislation, such as in the Victorian laws, where 30% of those charged with image-based abuse were aged 10 to 17 years old. Do you think that there is a particular issue with Gen Z or the Generation Internet, many of whom are still children, that at this age you kind of can't operate with a level of self-awareness or responsibility that perhaps the technology demands of you?
Look, it's probably complex on many levels. I think part of the issue actually is that the subjects of photos who are under 18 can't consent by law to being the subject of that image. So it's not just that it's you know, the picture is shared without consent. You know, just taking a sexual photo of anyone aged under 18 is a crime under Commonwealth law. So there's no space in which consent is possible in that framework. Mm-hmm. I have some concerns for under 18s that law can be used as a means of prosecuting young people in spaces where actually otherwise the incident might have been consenting. So say, for example, two 16-year-olds who are over the age of consent for actual sex. Mm-hmm. Also have pictures of each other on their phones. That phone image would be illegal regardless if that kid is perceived as a bad kid, quote unquote, and asked to turn out their pockets and that picture is on their phone. The picture is a crime regardless of whether the sex was consenting. So it's kind of quite a complex area, and I would need to look at each incident case by case. Mm. To consider what was the context of that. Is that simply an image that was either taken without consent, which many of the images are, or circulated without consent, or is it a space in which the young people were actually in a consenting relationship, but the law doesn't make it possible for them to consent?
So there's not really a black and white way that you can frame all of these cases or look at them all under the same...
You wouldn't... For under 18s, the laws are quite different, so you can't assume that it's something to do with under 18-year-old psychology when the law is actually treating them differently. You would need to look at the context of the situation.
Thanks to Professor of Media and Communication, Keith Albury.
Hi, I'm Paul Gough. Join me every Sunday here on 2SER at 5 for Playback, brought to you by APRA AMCOS. We'll go deep and wide in search of the best in new Australian music, and we'll dig very deep into the archives as well. That's Playback with me, Paul Gough, 5 p.m. Sundays on 2SER 107.3.
Sydney, you asked and we answered for 2SER's weekly Seeking Sydney segment, where reporters here at the station investigate questions submitted by 2SER listeners on our website. This week, I answered your question, how was Fort Denison built on such a tiny island in the middle of Sydney Harbour?
Our warships have the white flag indicating Navy, our red flag indicates we're home. Navy. The blue flag is the national flag. This is Fort Denison.
Welcome to Seeking Sydney, where we answer your curious questions about our harbour city. I'm Monica Samioa. This week, we answered a question sent in by our very own Michael Jones. How did they build Fort Denison on such a little island in the middle of Sydney Harbour? To get the most accurate and correct information, I had help from Discovery Coordinator David Thompson. So first things first, we're going to give you a brief history of Fort Denison.
This is the Martello Tower. It's on Fort Denison here. It's one of two in the Southern Hemisphere, and this is the most complete one in the world. Now, the Martello Towers come about from... It was during the Napoleon Wars, where two British warships with over 100 guns on board went to attack an island called Corsica. And in the bay there that they were entering, called Martella Bay, that's where Martello Tower came from, they saw one of these towers, just one of the towers, nothing else, and they couldn't get past it with their 100 guns, and they were so impressed with the design that the British built 187 of these throughout their interests around the world. And as I said, there's two in the Southern Hemisphere, one in South Africa and one here in Australia.
David told me in the original design, the entrance is supposed to be made on the second level, which would then require a rope and a ladder to get inside. But since it's such a small island, they decided to make the entrance at the bottom, magazines in the second level and the guns on top. Towards the bottom of the tower, there are about 4 meters thick of sandstone, and at the top, it is nearly 3 meters thick. In the first level of the tower, you will find the magazine storage room, and on the second level houses the guns that are over 200 years old. It took about 10 men to operate and fired 36-pound projectiles. After explaining how much effort and strength it takes to operate the guns, David then told me something that surprised me.
There was never any shots fired in anger from Fort Denison. What had happened is when it was built, it took so many years to build. They started building and started considering the fort in the 1830s. And it was because of two American warships coming into our harbour in 1836. We didn't know they were coming. There was no mobile or email. They came in the evening. Britain had just been to war with America. And they came into our colony the next morning to say hello, but they also brought in a scenario. Last night, we entered your harbour, destroyed everything that you had, and left before sun rose. And that put the chills up our colony here, thinking that was quite embarrassing. They could do anything. So we started to scramble around to build fortifications. We had a couple here and there, but we thought Fort Denison would be a great place.
They brought convicts to start flattening the island with explosives and quarrying the stone to reclaim land towards Circular Quay.
Around Circular Quay, if you've been there, you'll see these little round circles, and it'll say Shoreline 1857 or 1815 or something like that. So it grew and grew and grew into what it is today. And much of that stone that they used came from Fort Denison, because as I mentioned, it was inferior stone. It couldn't be used for building. And a lot of the stone they just took out and dumped in the harbour as well. So a lot of the stuff they really didn't want, the smaller stone and things like that. So they just dumped it into Sydney Harbour.
After a while, they stopped building Fort Denison because, well, they didn't have permission. There were no funds allocated until 1845, which then took 12 years to complete until 1857.
Another reason people don't think about these days is what happened in 1852, where we needed to fortify Australia. And a lot of people don't think of it. We discovered gold. We became very rich very quickly, and we even heard rumours of other countries putting together raiding parties where they were going to come out and raid our colony for all our gold reserves, but no one ever turned up. And it's something that slipped away in history, but people don't think about the fact that we had to really think about protecting ourselves.
So after all that hard work to make one of the most secure and safe towers in the Southern Hemisphere, it was never put to use. They didn't even have an army personnel at the tower.
Army force out here, they put a lot of volunteers out here, and if anyone's heard of the old program Dad's Army, that's what it was like. It was just a whole lot of 44 volunteers out here. They were poorly trained. They had to buy their own uniforms and make their own uniforms, but it was later on they sent out two soldiers to help train them, and it brought up their morale, but they never even fired the guns, the volunteers, and so it was obsolete, but they still had to look like they were using it.
I was so curious to know, with no machinery, how exactly were they able to flatten the stone, and how long did it take?
The stone, it was just with picks and coal chisels, you know, like just those types of tools. And you get a hammer and you just face, it's called facing the rock. And so they do that all by hand and all by, you know, just labour. And the stonemasons that work out here today, they because we were constantly replacing stone, because it does erode, it does deteriorate. And they do the same thing, but they do that back at their workplaces. But just with picks, it's all hard labour, and there was no machinery back then, and it would have been very, very hard work. And the way that they pick this stone up, and it can be quite heavy, you know, we're looking at 3 tons of pop here, of some of the stone, and they'd have a triangular wooden arch, and it'd be obviously the pointy part going up. Then they'd put that into position, in the upright position where they want their stone to be. But then they come along and they lower it down to where the piece of stone is. They attach the stone to the wood on that with the block and tackle. Then, with ropes, they raise that triangular piece back up, therefore picking up the piece of stone and placing it into the place that they want it to be. But they'd have that all worked out because they didn't want to actually start trying to roll this stone because they just didn't know where it was, how heavy it was, actually. But
today, Fort Denison isn't just a sweet spot to watch the New Year's Eve fireworks or have a wedding reception. There's a computer-operated tide gauge that goes 20 meters deep that records currents every 5 seconds.
And you know what? Most people, when they come out here, say, I've come past this place all my life and I've never been here. And one of the great things I love to say is, well, you're here now and it doesn't matter. Now you're here and you can see what it's all about.
If you have a chance to visit Fort Denison during the summer, you will not only get to witness a great piece of history, but you'll also see the best view of Sydney Harbour. I'd like to thank Michael for asking this question and also David Thompson for teaching us a little bit about our history right here in Sydney Harbour. If you'd like for us to answer a question you have about Sydney, like why are the streets so crazily arranged and hard to navigate, or is there really a lake underneath the Sydney streets, send them over. We would love to answer your questions. Head on over to 2scr.com and look for Seeking Sydney for the previous stories and to submit your question. Thank you again to David Thompson for helping Seeking Sydney answer your question. Now on to our last story. This week on The Wire, hosts of 2SCR's Glam City, Dr. Tansen Peach and Dr. Anna Clark, spoke with proud Wardry man Nathan Sentence, whose life goal is to decolonize the archives. Nathan works as a First Nations Cultural Programs Officer at the Australian Museum. He thinks it's important that memory institutes people their collections and wants the glam sector, that's galleries, libraries, archives, and museums, to not just collect the objects, but connect them to the people and cultures they come from.
Well, Aboriginal epistemology, I'm talking about sort of Aboriginal knowledge systems. Something like the Australian Museum, which is considered a natural history museum, works a lot with Western knowledge and Western science, and I'd like to incorporate Indigenous science into that, but not just incorporate, but also in a way that's not tokenistic or sort of, or even exploitative, more like in a way that validates Aboriginal knowledge and puts it in the same sort of area, or like a, you know, a respectable reverence as Western science, because, you know, Indigenous knowledge has sort of kept Australia sort of sustainable for a long time. And it's, yeah, globally you see Indigenous science from like the Native Americans or the First Nations Canadians, and people sort of using that information now to learn more about the world and about themselves and how to actually maintain the world.
This is an anecdote, which apropos of your comment there, I've been doing some research on the history of fishing in Australia, and one of the things I've been reading recently was from an explorer actually in Wiradjuri country, and he talks about walking past rivers and that the guys he was going with were throwing lines in to the water, and that he was saying that the Wiradjuri people were standing on the riverbanks laughing because they had just fished there. So there is and he writes this in his diary that these, you know, they were all laughing and that they, you know, that this exploration party really didn't know what they were doing or talking about. So there has been an acknowledgement of Indigenous knowledge of this country for a long time. It's not just something that's happened in the last 10 years.
But there's also been like a big sort of forgetness of Aboriginal knowledge as well. Like one of the stories I like to talk about, because it's like not just a Sydney story, but it's a Sydney woman story, is about in Eora, while men fished, they used to fish on the sides. The people that would go out into the water and fish were the local Gadigal women, and they actually had the fishing knowledge, and they were actually considered like, you know, the holders of the fishing knowledge. But when Europeans first came, they actually asked the men, because they assumed from, you know, the gender roles in Western society, that's how it would work in, Aboriginal societies. So they didn't actually, and lost out on a lot of sort of, you know, keen fishing knowledge because of that. But then they started fishing, and one of the stories I recently read, which I kind of like, was about sustainability. The way Aboriginal people fished was like not gluttonous, you know, they'd fish for themselves, or they'd also fish seasonally, so they would give time for fish to replenish. But Barangaroo, which that place is named after, she once saw these European men sort of fish and took about, you know, 200, like it was like just this big bag of fish, more fish than the people around. And she nearly broke down in tears because she just thought it was so gluttonous and wasteful, and it's probably ruining the waterways for a little time being. So, yeah.
I'm fascinated by this notion of forgetting because, you know, you talk about museums and galleries and libraries maybe and archives as memory institutes.
Yeah.
But there's also this silencing that they have affected.
Yeah.
And you describe yourself as an archival decolonist.
Yeah.
I mean, can you talk about what that means in the context of memory institutes?
Well, I think memory institutions have a long time have been privileging certain voices. Even with, say, with the Australian Museum, Gadigarang, our Sea Country exhibition, which is a beautiful exhibition, that was the first exhibition in 190 years of collecting Aboriginal and displaying Aboriginal objects that was actually curated by Aboriginal people.
Wow.
So if you think about that, like, Aboriginal stories have long been not told, and then when they have been told, they've been told from European perspectives, which have had, you know, repercussions. Like, one of the problems too is, like, say with the Australian Museum or most natural history museums, when they present First Nations people, they present them from an anthropological point of view, and because they don't really understand First Nations people, they present them, you know, they'll use terms like primitive, savage, and what it does is actually dehumanizes Aboriginal people to the punters that go through. Mm. The punters go through, see these institutions as, you know, they're the primary sources of information, so they should see them as reputable. So once they hear that, see that, they can be justified in also dehumanizing Aboriginal people. That's one of the issues with sort of these sort of places. And it isn't just museums. It is art galleries presenting Aboriginal art as sort of outsider art. It is archives only collecting and prefacing the written word, which has, you know, long sort of excluded Aboriginal people. And libraries doing the same, or, like, you know, even sort of like academic research, you know, academic archives keeping research on Aboriginal people, but it's done by non-Aboriginal people, and it's sort of, again, so because people will continue to go back to these sources. So if you go through historical sources as a non-Indigenous person, if you went through these sources, you'd be getting the story of Aboriginal people from non-Indigenous people, and it sort of continues itself on, like, and it does leave out a lot of voices, and it also does leave out lots of bit of, like, culture and perspective and stuff like that. Like, one of the stories I like to always think about was, like, a story that Kirsten Thorpe, the archivist, and also the head of Indigenous Services at the State Library in New South Wales, she was telling me that when she used to work at State Records of New South Wales, they have the reserve records there. So people would go there, stolen generation people would want to read their records about themselves or their family, and they would read these records and be like, this is wrong, like, I was there. But the thing is, you know, these aunties and uncles that will have these stories, these lived experiences, won't be as considered as valid as a written record, which even a written record has its own agendas and biases.
Nathan Sentence, a proud Wurundjeri man, ending that report, produced by Emma Lancaster. And if you'd like to hear the full conversation, head over to 2scr.com and look for Glam City, or subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Check out just some of the new music on 2SER this week. Dreamy and creamy love jams from the Cactus Channel. Mythical and mariachi-style moves from Sydney's Dusty Ravens.
I point my horse where there's nowhere left to go. Past others left to die beside the road.
And after three decades, the return of pop perfectionists' ups and downs.
Messy business.
2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, and the best in new music.
That brings us to the end of this edition of Razor's Edge, 2SER's home for New South Wales news. I'm Monica Samioa, and we'll be back next week at 7:30 p.m. Thursday evening with stories big and small. We tweet and podcast all our stories during and after the show, so follow Razor's Edge on Twitter and check out all of our past stories and all the amazing content made here at 2SER. Also, don't forget to submit your questions to our Seeking Signy segment. We'd love to see how curious you are and how you want to answer as many questions as we can. So go on to 2scr.com, look for Seeking Sydney, and submit your questions, Sydneysiders. Don't go anywhere, because Static is up next with 2 hours of awesome new music for you.
That the community has a right to be informed and that the community has the right to fight for what it loves.
A defence which has been on the rise and has cost Australians up to $1 billion.
Most people sort of fantasise about flying. Most people think about it. But rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? I've only done like 1%.
And bang, it was in like a split second. I had no time to react. I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.